and subtitled Everything You Always Wanted to Know About Politics or Politicians But Were Afraid to Ask. And the way we came up with that title was that one of the other, I guess the Larry Rasmussen seminar, somebody made a statement in there saying, well, all those politicians are crooked anyway. And I figured that's one perspective on the world of politics. I have some others I'd like to share. And I see we have at least one other elected official, a Seattle City Council member here. And so we may get more than one perspective on it. But I'd like to leave this as, I hope it was advertised, the second breakfast this way, but largely an open forum where you get to ask whatever questions you want. I have a few comments I'll make to start out. And then leave it open for basically whatever you want to discuss about politics. Was suggesting not particularly about issues. I'd be happy to talk about issues. I've had a couple talks on them already and be happy to do more on that. But if there are other questions about the nature of politics or faith in politics or whatever sort of thing you want to ask, I would suggest we center it around that sort of thing, and otherwise just let it go whichever direction you want it to go. For a little bit of background, I'm Minnesota State Senator, so I deal with state issues, not national issues. I'm a member of the Democratic Farmer Labor, DFL, party in Minnesota, which corresponds nationally to the Democratic Party. This is my first term. I've worked for U.S. Congress for less than a year, and I worked for the state legislature in Minnesota doing research for about 4 years, but I'm in my first year in office now. And I, like all of you, is a concerned Christian who tries to relate my career, my interests to my faith, and that's my background. And a few of the things just to get people started about thinking about maybe some things that you may want to discuss. First of all, with the title, Are All Politicians Crooked? Well, I don't personally believe that, and I don't think you'd be here if you thought that was the case either. There is definitely corruption in politics. It tends to make it in the news media as big stuff, and it well should, because political leaders tend to have a lot of power. And if we have corruption in high places, it has devastating consequences for many people. So we don't want corruption there. And clearly there are some corrupt politicians. I would argue that the political leadership of the country is fairly reflective of the population as a whole. Philosophically, I mean, the country as a whole, we have conservatives, liberals, and every kind of other philosophy, and our political leadership reflects that as well. Honesty-wise, there are some highly conscientious, honest people, and there are some who you wouldn't want to buy a used car from, but that's true of the population at large as well. There are some very intelligent leaders, there are some not as bright. It's a wide range of things, and that's my comments right now on honesty. If that spurs more questions, fine. Another issue that came up and we had a lengthy discussion about last week in a different forum was the idea of how a political decision maker decides and how they should decide. Assuming I believe one thing and my constituents believe another thing. If I phrase it that way, I think most people would say, well, you ought to do what your constituents want. If I phrase it a different way, should I vote my conscience or what a majority of the public in my district happens to think at the time, which should I go with, my conscience or the politically popular one? I think more people would suggest you ought to go with your conscience. I personally am of that philosophy that one ought to go with their conscience. The way our system is a representative democracy works is not by having a direct democracy might be a majority opinion on every issue, which has existed in a few town meetings in New England, but traditionally in our country, it can't work. There are just too many people. If you try and get 10,000 people to agree on anything, you're going to have a tough time. I mean, maybe yes or no type questions, but most political questions aren't yes or no. So we have a Republican form of democracy where we elect leaders to make decisions for us, and if they are too far out of touch, we replace them. One might say the way they keep in touch is by reading the public opinion, sampling questionnaires for their constituents all the time, and voting according to the majority will there. But the majority will often, or most times I would suggest, is 55% or 60% or maybe 65-35. Usually things aren't 95% to 5% in favor or in opposition to something, so your constituents are not 100% certain themselves. Plus you have the problem that they change at times. The public opinion does change, as I and everybody's personal opinion does as well, but that can cause drastic changes if we decide one way one month and then some news item comes out in the public massively changes its mind. You might have a very back and forth type of government. Another problem with that is, how do you know? I could take a poll of my constituents every month. The issues often come up on a half a day's notice. There's no realistic way to get a good reading of constituent opinion. So if I come up with some issue that I feel this is the right position, I've had the chance to study it, maybe not in depth, maybe not 3 weeks of work on this one little issue, maybe it's been 20 minutes of study of the issue. Presumably that's more time than most of my constituents have had to study the issue, many of whom the most possible involvement they have time for is reading the daily paper, and for many people there's not even time for that. So I have the advantage of having studied it, and I come down, this is what I think makes the most sense. It's based on my background, my faith. I think it's the right thing to do. We can talk about what morally right is. But I conclude that position X is the right position. Then somebody says, well, that's unpopular with your constituents. 2-1, they're going to oppose that. Well, do I go with my constituents or do I go with my reasoned approach? I would choose to go with what I think is right and then follow up with the responsibility to communicate to my constituents, here's the position I took, here's why I took the position, and why I believe it's the correct position to have taken. Then if at the end of my term, if there are a whole number of these controversial issues and every time I've come down on the opposite side and I've explained my case and they haven't bought my case, they will vote me out of office. But I would suggest that that's a better way to decide than going by unreliable, more often it's a sampling in your own mind, what you think is popular or unpopular. And because there tend to be on certain issues very vocal minorities, do they represent the majority opinion, or is it just the people who take the time to write the most letters and so on? So I would suggest that the best way for a politician to make decisions is based on what they think after their own opinion, after they've studied the issues, after they've heard from constituents, because constituents do bring in new perspectives, they do bring in depth of caring. If you hear a whole lot of people feel strongly about something and you're kind of up in the air about it, that may be the decisive factor. But I'm suggesting there are a whole range of factors that a politician in their own mind has to base their decision on. I've talked only about 5 minutes or 10 minutes now, but I would like to open it up and suggest some of the things you may want to talk about are sort of things on pressures or conflicting pressures facing legislators or politicians. How better might constituents and their elected officials relate to each other, both in information exchange and awareness of what's happening? And also campaign styles. Do people want everything in their own interest? And I'll greed, self-interest, I'll discuss one that we'll all agree on, and that is nobody likes taxes, everybody wants lower taxes. The typical, quote, politician would appeal to both the fact that people want lower taxes and they want better schools, they want better roads, they want better these things. And so you can give them all of that in a campaign brochure, talk about how you're committed to improving the schools, how you're committed to better police and fire protection, how you're committed to better this, all these good things that everybody wants, and you're also going to cut back on taxes. And our federal government has reflected this largely through their deficit spending. Most states, including ours, does not allow that, so most campaign literature that's appealing to the selfish interest in people is talking, just stretching the way that, about how you're committed to lower taxes and all these other good things. But maybe there would be some questions about whether you have to appeal to the self-interest of people or whether you can appeal to their community interest as well. But I'll just open it up there and shut up and take questions.
John, you mentioned getting letters. How influential would a letter from me be, for example, if I were one of your constituents and I wrote you not a form letter, but a personal note or a typewritten letter that expressed some view on something? What's the process? What happens to that letter?
Okay.
Where do I stand then as your constituent?
And again, because politicians decide in different ways, it would influence different politicians differently. First, I'll tell you how it would affect me. The fact that you took the time to handwrite or hand type a personal letter means a whole lot more than the fact that somebody signed a petition or mailed in a postcard or even made a phone call. I think I could take a petition out there arguing for one thing one day and get hundreds of signatures, and next day come back with something worded differently that in effect would propose the opposite, and I could get a lot of signatures too. It's the nature of people like to please. It doesn't show a big commitment to something to sign your name on a petition. Same thing with you put a postage stamp on a card and dear representative or senator fill in the blank. And we get a lot of those. Every lobbying group does that is the strategy. And clearly you get 300 people sending you postcards on something or 500 people caring about that. It shows there's some community awareness, maybe all generated by a lobbying group, but it shows some awareness, and so you pay attention to that. You ought to, I mean, you're going to if you're concerned about your future in politics. For self-interest reasons alone, you're going to pay attention. If somebody takes the time to write a reasoned letter to you saying, I oppose this because of this reason, and so on, and they say, I understand the alternate side is this, but I don't think that's right because of so-and-so. It also depends what level of government you're dealing with, but at my level, I'm going to read that, and I'm going to read it carefully, and I'm going to respond. And it's presumably because I try and keep an open mind, and we all come with our own base starting point, but it's going to influence me a little bit. And that may be the thing that tips me over the edge to support a certain position, or it may not be. But it's going to have some influence, it's going to get me thinking about it, and in responding to you, I reflect that. At the federal level or the presidential level, where there are obviously unanswerable amount of mail for one person to answer, the legislator or president is not going to see your letter personally. What you're doing there is both is A, either providing new information on the issue or letting them know you're one more person who cares about it, or more likely both. And so there is some sort of, every person that contacts you, it sways you a little bit, and the more in-depth, the more careful the wording, the more that would impact on me. And I'd suggest there are some people, I don't know how many, who tend to go, you know, they get 500 pieces of mail on something and 200 for the other side, they may vote that way. I would suggest there definitely are people that way. There's also those who just absolutely would throw out postcards as being, well, they'll respond to them, but they won't, it won't sway them in any way. Does that, any, go ahead.
In the national elections for Congress as well as president, to what extent do you think the 30-second television spot really helps voters make up their mind, and to what extent do you think that that gives the voters any real perception of what that person's point of view on issues might be?
I'll suggest very little, and I'll suggest that that's one of the weaknesses of our democracy. And what would I do about it? Well, I guess I really don't have any answers for it. I'll make several comments about it, however. One is that I don't know of any better way to do things. I can suggest ways that I would change, like we ought to get away from the 30-second spots. Perhaps at the congressional level we could do some sort of public financing combined with some sort of agreement with, these are public airwaves, at least the main networks are on public airwaves, not cable and private stuff, but they are licensed by us because they're only a limited number of airwaves. And in exchange for giving them that, perhaps we could do some sort of arrangement where they will sell from far cheaper rates longer periods of time. You do 5 minutes of commercial, and I know in the past presidential election and so on, there were some things that looked like Pepsi commercials and good feeling types of things that dragged on for like 5 minutes. But you start talking 15 minutes, 5 minutes, that kind of period, it's more likely people are going to get into substance. So I think there are some alternatives to what we're doing, and I would hope we move that way. It would also suggest that, like the 30-second spot says very little. Most campaign literature says very little. They may tell you somebody's qualifications, background, and so on. Always, of course, designed in a positive light. Everybody, not just politicians, likes to present themselves in a positive light. We care about the way we dress. We care about the way we talk. We care about everything we do because we want to please people. In politicians, it's just the nature of the job. You have to please 51% of the people in order to keep your job. But in doing so, in expressing yourself positively in campaign literature or in TV commercials, you can do it in several ways. One is you can be just, I'm a nice guy kind of thing. Here's the background, here's the family, here's all that. And I'll say my campaign literature had a lot of that in it because I think I'm a person that deserves their trust, and I believed in my candidacy strongly and wanted to persuade the voters of that as well. But there are other things you can do as well, one of which is attack your opponent, which we saw a lot of that as well too. And public says, why is there so much negative campaigning? Well, the professional campaign consultants say it works. I'm not absolutely convinced that it does, but we had, well, one of our elections about 4 years ago, one of the legislative caucuses in the House had a campaign strategist going around talking to their candidates, and person was quoted in the Minneapolis Tribune as saying, use radio spots to attack your opponents. People rarely hear the whole thing, and you should use that brief bit that they do hear to try and portray your opponent as the scum of the earth. And that quote became a campaign point that people pointed out, look, about how not only are they attacking their opponents, that's actually their strategy to try and mislead people by hoping they don't hear it all, and they think their opponent is, they try and portray their opponent in a nasty way. And at the national level in U.S. Senate campaigns, there's been an incredible amount of nastiness. You'd think that's why people think politicians are all crooks. I mean, because they hear all this, both sides attacking each other. I wouldn't vote for either one of them if the stuff in all the commercials was accurate. And yet, I'll argue that most politicians are caring people. I obviously philosophically disagree with half of them, and most people, I mean, there are people on every range of the spectrum. I cast 2,000 some votes a year, counting committees and so on. There's no other member of the legislature that votes exactly the way I do. I disagree with everybody else, and they all disagree with me. But despite the fact that we have strong philosophical disagreements, I respect the fact that they really care. Many of them have deeply felt philosophical beliefs like I do and support those as such. So you can have different philosophies and you can really care, and you can point out your opponent's faults, but you don't have to do it in a stretch the truth kind of way. I can think in my own campaign, I lived in the Twin Cities area for about 9 years, and we happened to move just under 2 years before the election to a new house, and it happened to be a couple miles away, and it was a new district. And my opponent portrayed it in the campaign is he had this piece of literature, personal background, him versus me. First line was birthplace. His was our Senate district. Mine was Chicago, Illinois. Next line, years in our district. And it was less than two, so it was honest for him to say one for me and 12 for him. And so I had people all the time asking me, did you move from Chicago last year? And suggesting I had no connections with Minnesota, no connections with my community, no connections with anything. And I did. And I think he could argue, yeah, I've only lived in the district less than 2 years. I think that would have been a fair campaign issue. But, you know, you stretch it a little bit. And he didn't say I moved from Chicago the year before, but putting the birthplace in the, I've never seen somebody put birthplace on campaign literature as a comparison thing, but birthplace, and then the next line was years in our district. And there was clearly the intention to mislead. And I would say that serves no useful purpose in our democracy. On the other hand, what you can also put in campaign literature or on commercials is a summary of your views on the issue. And obviously a 30-second television spot doesn't give you time to do more than a cliche or two. I happen to put out about 20 pages, I think if you single space normal typewritten page, I think we had almost 20 pages of issue papers out. I'm not sure that any of my constituents read all of them. I would guess my opponent's campaign read them all, trying to find good stuff to use. But I don't think the constituents as a whole read them all, and I didn't expect them to. The hope was that if somebody has a particular interest in education, here's 40 points, here's little things that I think we should be changing as a state in them, or on tax issues. And it wasn't all, I'm going to be cutting taxes, because when my opponent took it to be saying that he made a statement in the debate and so on, that my opponent has publicly stated that he will not support a cut in taxes, or that he will oppose a cut in taxes, and that's not exactly what I said, but nevertheless, I think they were responsible position papers. People could read them and disagree with them. And I figure 10% of the public may have taken interest and read some of my position papers, maybe a little more than that. And for those people, they had a chance to judge on that. And I would argue that while some people disagreed with them, some of those people may have voted for me anyway, just the fact that they knew where I was coming from. They had that feel. And I'd suggest very few candidates take the time to do that. The U.S. Senate race, you may get a little brochure that gives so-and-so supports strong Social Security. They do this, and it may be 10 bullet-type points they support. And that's not real in-depth on the issues. Of course, you do have the thing where somebody's an incumbent, which I wasn't. You can find out something about where they're coming from by where their voting record has been in the past. And if you... That's not easy to find out. The papers don't do a lot of reporting on that. But if you want to go and spend the time finding out where a legislator has voted, you can do that. And so you can learn some from their past. But in a new campaign like mine, where neither myself nor my opponent were an incumbent, I think it's very important. And that's something the candidate has to do. It's your own style. I would argue that you can spell out your soul on where you stand on things, and you can take on tough positions, not just, yeah, I support lower taxes and more spending. You can rationally argue things that are not always in the public self, in individual self-interest. Maybe the community self-interest, but not your personal self-interest. You can appeal to that, and people will respect you for it. And you can win an election doing that, too. And I would suggest that my case was a proof of that. That's the issue papers didn't win it, but door knocking and other things along with them, I think it shows that you can change it. It's not real optimistic, but if people don't start asking their candidates for more, they're not going to get it.
I think going back to what you said about Kivimaki's statement that you make your opponent look like the scum of the earth, the party that he was working for did not win very much that year. And I think, you know, you just mentioned door knocking, but that 82 was the year that in southeast Minnesota, in my Senate district, that was the approach used by a young man who unseated an incumbent. Tim Penny went around with the same thing, facing this Kivimaki's make your opponent look like a scum of the earth. Of course, it helped Tim Penny be running against a competitor who had, they used to play alley cat when he came into political conventions. However, Tim Penny used that where he's born better. The other, his opponent, was going to, didn't even live in the district, but was running. And Tim just kept saying, I was born in this district and I've lived here all my life, which, you appreciate. But it is that door knocking and that contact that appears to be more significant. I think it would sway some people on the 32nd glitches. Unfortunately, they may be more and more. Well, the bigger thing you're running for, though, if you're running for a Senate seat, or a state Senate position, or a rep position, you can do more door knocking. If you're running for a congressional district, you've got a larger, more people. You run statewide, and you can't do all that door knocking. So levels also, and national office, running for national office.
Yes, I think that it is. I mean, in my case, I will suggest that you're saying about the small percentage of people, when I said 15% may have read my issue papers, well, if that swayed 5% in my favor, I won with 53% of the vote. I mean, that's enough right there to make the difference. You could also argue, well, my door knocking made the difference for 20% of the people. So obviously, if I just wrote these issue papers and distributed them, I was going to lose. So I, and clearly in my kind of race, the contact I can make with my constituents is one-on-one in meetings, in going door-to-door, that sort of thing. At a higher level of office where you're representing 500,000 to, in U.S. Senate in California, 40-some million people, you can't contact each of them personally. You can't talk with them that way. It's stretching the edge in our area where we got 62,000 some people. But nevertheless, you can make a real, in making your personal contact or in making your contact in speeches and so on, you can appeal to the groups in different ways. And I'd suggest issues can be a part of that. And it's partly what the public asks for, demands of candidates.
Could you comment on what you were talking on about selfishness in politics? Example, people want lower taxes, but they're not prepared. They're not prepared to support mental health or schools or etc. etc. That seems to be a trend over the last 10 years. It's really strong in California where we live.
Yes, I. That whole issue of what you appeal to in campaigns, and as I briefly suggested at least, I don't think you have to appeal to self-interest, and self-interest can be phrased in a very negative way as greed, but you can, I don't mean to suggest all self-interest is greed. We are supposed to take care of ourselves, we are supposed to look out for ourselves, and so it's not all greed, but greed is the extreme of it. And sometimes politicians catering to that tend to be appealing to greed. And I don't think that's necessary. I think people sort of respond to what's appealed to in them. If you expect selfishness, if you expect self-concern only, people give that back to you. If you appeal to generosity, community spirit, building a healthier economy, people will respond to that too. And then, of course, you usually have one candidate appealing to one and one to the other, which wins. I guess I'd suggest it doesn't mean so much that the public is all so strongly self-interested that the candidate who appeals to that wins, but that it's more of how well you sell whatever you're appealing to. If, as many politicians have done in the past 10 years, you appeal to lower taxes, lower taxes, lower taxes. You want more money. What do you want? This wasteful government, and everybody sees waste in government. You want the wasteful government determining where your money's going to be spent, or do you want to spend it yourself? I think I could take a poll of this room, and I'll guarantee 99% or better probably 100% will say they want lower taxes. I could also appeal to the fact that, you know, if we take care of the mentally ill in our society, if we take care of our senior citizens who are in poor health and need to be in a nursing home, if we take care of making sure we have a good educational system, why we'll have a better, healthier economy overall, because it doesn't do us any good to have somebody suffering in poor health and suffering from unemployment. Because unless we want them to absolutely starve, we're going to be paying welfare costs for them. So the more we can get everybody contributing to society, the better we'll all be. So there are two things you can appeal to, and I think if you appeal more effectively to the one, to the generous thing, you can win. And that's what I would suggest my campaign literature talked about. I said some things that I'm sure were very positive things as well, but I also talked about some tough things. My tax position paper was about 2.5 pages long, and it was not saying I was going to cut taxes, but talking about the balance of taxes, talking about the fact that at times you have to spend money to save money. And that can be in the form of road repair, where you repair the road now rather than in Minnesota let it split open wider and the ice just crumbles it over winter, or wait until the last minute when it's already crumbled and then pay twice as much then. Or environmental protection. You can not do anything to stop people from just dumping waste anywhere they want, and then 10 years down the road, 20 years down the road, you got seeping landfills destroying the water supply and extremely costly cleanup. Every issue, I think I can make some case where there may be a point where spending money would actually save money. Not every issue, but there are a lot of them. I think that can be the case. And by, in a sense, that's self-interest too. If you want to look at it that way, appealing to the, even if a family doesn't have any kids in school, saying we need good schools, maybe in that family's self-interest, not a narrow self-interest, but to have a well-educated, well-employed, productive community is in that community, is in that couple's best interest. And so it's not always self-interest versus community interest. Sometimes enlightened self-interest is the same thing as community interest. And I'll give Hubert Humphrey as an example of somebody who appealed to the best in people. He's long dead now, and he had certainly a lot of issues that everybody across every range of the spectrum is going to disagree with him on, but countless times, as far as major legislation at the federal level, this century he undoubtedly had more impact than anyone else. I mean, food for peace program, nuclear test ban, civil rights, across the board on civil rights, Medicare, Medicaid, all those sorts of things were often proposed by Humphrey in the late 40s and 60s, they became law. But civil rights, going and talking in Minnesota, which is a very small minority population, especially in the 40s and so on, when he was running for Senate the first time, he goes to the Democratic National Convention and blasts racism, and he says about how we got to learn to live together. There was a lot of anti-Semitism in Minneapolis at the time. There was a lot of other forms of racism and bigotry, partly because minorities were such a small percentage. Yeah, he went out there and appealed to that non-self-interest, the controversial stuff we don't want to hear, and he won. And he held a seat. He was the first Democratic senator in Minnesota in a good number of years, beating an incumbent. So
I was thinking about Gary Hart and the idea that the press asked him directly if he committed adultery. And I was wondering about how you deal with something like that, that pulls the spectrum of either saying full disclosure and invading your privacy, or refusing to and then having people be suspicious of you.
I'll answer that in the, I don't know if it's a full answer or not, but one point about that, Gary Hart in a sense had it coming to himself, telling the press, follow me around if you want. I mean, he had been accused of womanizing, and he suggested, come follow me around, and you could accuse him of stupidity, if nothing else, because telling people to follow you and then getting caught a week later was not the smartest thing you could do. I would argue with I would argue that a politician's private life ought to be private, their own business. But on the other hand, you can make the case and that maybe he showed less than a full respect for women, and that might be something that tempers his policies that people should be aware of. I don't know that there's any clear-cut thing that I should have everybody analyze. I don't think I have any skeletons in the closet, but I don't particularly care to have everybody asking every question about my personal childhood and so on. Some politicians are very secretive, and they feel it's their own personal life, and they feel very strongly about it. Others really, you know, hey, I have nothing to hide. And those who do say they want to be private about it, they don't necessarily have anything to hide. They just think it's none of the public's business. And
so how do you answer a question that's very
intrusive? I guess accusing, there is no perfect way. It's not necessarily a fair question. Again, in Gary Hart's case, I don't know that the press has asked that of most of the candidates, and it may be because of the way he was doing with it. And I guess if he hadn't put himself in that box, the best answer is I frankly think that's none of the public's business. And Jesse Jackson's wife was saying something about how, you know, if her husband was involved in something like this, she didn't want to hear about it, so just stay out of it. And that may be, if every politician is willing to say that's none of your business, which I believe and I can't recall, but I think that's what Gary Hart said. It's just in light of the situation around him, it was kind of it was a bad situation for him to be in.
But as you were saying before, every politician likes to say I'm a good family man, and every biography politician says that's false. And then every time he campaigns, he puts his arm around his wife and his kids and shows how great a family man he is for 5 minutes. And if someone does that, isn't it just as correct to analyze that statement as his position that I'm against lower taxes, and then find out he voted for them all the time, he's in favor of his wife and his children, and he ignores them totally? You know, it seems to me if you're campaigning on the basis, I'm a good family man, trust me, then we ought to investigate that. And if you don't want your family life to be investigated, don't even put the fact that you're married and have a family on the campaign brochure. But every politician does. And as long as he puts it up there, we surely have good reason to investigate. Your main claim to be elected is that you've got a nice wife and family.
And that's the key. I think you make a real good point that, I mean, in a sense, not just Gary Hart, but everyone else who does this has the pretty family pictures taken, and we didn't have a dog. Somebody said, you want to borrow our dog? I mean, it's just nuts. I mean, people like those things. We didn't take a picture with a dog, but I mean, we have a family picture taken, and people like that, and they buy into it, and you've got a real legitimate point. If you're using that as a selling point, doesn't the public have a right to know otherwise?
I don't think it even matters if someone is using it as a selling point. You know, we have such an emphasis on the right to privacy in our country now, and we have an obligation to put men above reproach in office. And if you can't trust someone's moral integrity,
above reproach?
I'm just speaking generically.
So generic, man.
My point is that I don't want to put someone in office and give them power and authority if they don't have a reputation for moral integrity. You're entrusting them with an office, and they're taking and swearing an oath to rule themselves according to the Constitution. If they've demonstrated that there's not integrity in their life, then why would I want them to be in authority over me?
True.
Where are you going to find someone with integrity?
The trouble is, not where you're going to find someone with integrity, but how do you know? I mean, whoever has the most effective way of selling to you that they are the person of integrity may do it. Some of the most dishonest people have the best success at selling themselves as good, clean, decent family people and everything else. And I'll suggest that that the public does have a right to know some things. For instance, a financial disclosure. I think that's very important. Anything that may sway their decision-making. But there are people who, I mean, there have been presidents down the line in every lower office where presidents did, and every kind of philosophy, political philosophy, where, take presidents, for example, they had less than a perfect family life. And sometimes the public knew about it, most times the public didn't, but their family life was far from perfect. And nevertheless, that may have not had any impact on their decision-making. We're all human, we all have failures. Some of the, I mean, picking out particularly sexual sins as opposed to selfishness or other kinds of, I mean, economic sins perhaps, I don't know that we want to put too much focus on that, partly because you can't really know. I mean, I could tell you who I think are the people who really care about their families in the Minnesota legislature and which ones don't and which ones are likely to end up in divorce and which are likely to do this. But I don't know that that really is anything productive for our democracy, because people of all philosophies and of all kinds of personalities, some really caring people have some weakness or another, and I don't want to be picking out that as one particular area that we ought to be condemning people and saying you can't hold office because you did this. I don't know that that serves a useful purpose in making it a more responsive democracy.
Can I ask you a different kind of question? Doesn't it take a lot of money to run for office? And how can one contend with it if one does not have money in that?
Depends on the office. It's a good question. Money clearly talks, and it talks loudly. We are not personally wealthy. We raised money, and the more you have to raise, the tougher it is. And obviously, the more time you have to spend raising money, the less time you have for doing the constituent contact that's so important. In my particular case, it was a fluke thing that I had good campaign finance laws in Minnesota at the time. By accepting a spending limit, which in my case was $35,000, I qualified for about $9,000 in public money. Plus, at the time, the federal government had a 50% tax credit, and Minnesota had a 50% tax credit, both of which have since left, which meant that some individual could contribute $100 and get it all back at tax time. That meant some friends of mine who didn't have a lot of money could loan me, in effect, in their eyes, loan me money until next year at tax time and get it back. So I was able to raise the money that way. Without those campaign finance things, I'd have a lot tougher time. I wasn't supposed to win the money. All the lobbying groups, the lobbyists who work at the Capitol and who give money, they don't pick. I mean, there's some of them pick because so-and-so is of our philosophy, they'll support us on these 10 issues, therefore we're going to give them money. There are a lot of other ones that know they're going to have a range of issues they're working on. They want to give money to the winner. And I wasn't seen as the winner, and I didn't realize how strong it was till after the election, and I started hearing what people were saying about it. One example of that is one lobbying group, one lobbyist sent me a letter with a $400 contribution 2 weeks after the election saying, one of my clients, the so-and-sos, had contributed $400 to your opponent, or they are embarrassed to say they contributed $400 to your opponent. Or were unfortunate, I believe, was the word they used. Unfortunate, contributing $400 to your opponent. Here's $400 as they wish to make amends. They didn't give him $400 because they thought he'd be the best candidate, the best state senator, the best person for the state, even for their industry. They didn't all of a sudden decide I was the better one to do it. They simply wanted to, if you look at the real cynical way, you could say to buy votes. I'd suggest there's not such vote buying. There may be in cases, but it's not common. More likely is, you know, if somebody gives me $400 and wants to talk to me about something, I'm going to listen. And that's human nature. I'm not saying I personally am going to listen carefully because of it, but
did you send the check back?
I kept the check. And I'll be totally honest. I kept the check. I believe, and in my case, I can do it. Anybody who wants to talk to me about any issue, constituent or for that matter, non-constituent, I'll talk with them about it. And I've used this case so many times in explaining why I think our campaign finance laws stink so bad, that if I ever did any special favors for this particular lobbying group, I think it would be pretty clear. And But that's the whole problem with our campaign finance system. Nevertheless, in my particular case, I fell in right before some laws got removed, and I was able to raise $35,000. In most cases, I know Colorado did a study a couple years ago of ballot initiatives. When you put a particular issue on the ballot, like do you support, so we have a mandatory seatbelt law, you petition and you put it on the ballot. Colorado did a study a couple years ago. In the past 20 years, not once had the side that spent the most money lost. And the same tends to be true, like incumbency is a powerful reelection factor, finances is as well, but my opponent did spend $50,000. For which he had to forego the public financing, and it wasn't successful anyway. So money is one important factor, and it's a real problem. In newer candidates, less well-off candidates have real problems with it. So it's not fair, but I'd suggest campaign finance reform is a good one. Another elected official comment.
Well, I'd just like to add, I think that the way we finance elections is quite corrupt. And I think that every one of us needs to work very hard to try to get our elected officials to institute contribution limitations and public funding campaigns. And it's complex because I think it's true that the first time you ran, you tend to be more grassroots. And I ran against an incumbent in an at-large election, which means 500,000 constituents, and spent only $65,000, which as compared to a congressional race, which is 500,000 people roughly, you might spend hundreds of thousands and beat the incumbent with a 61% margin. So it's possible to run a grassroots campaign. However, now I'm running for re-election. And I sit with my finance committee and they say, Jim, you've got to learn to take that money because it's there and it's easy and it's in larger chunks, and there's all kinds of people there that are willing to give it to you. While you may not need it to get reelected for city council, if you ever want to run for mayor, it's a whole new ballgame. And instead of $60,000 for city council, you got to raise $250,000 to $300,000 for mayor. The first thing I did when I got in office was to lead the council to change the law to establish public funding of campaigns in Seattle. And I think that's significant positive. But politicians don't tend to do that without tremendous pressure from their constituents because they got in there and now it's all in their interest because, as he said, the cynical money, which is the largest percentage, goes to the incumbent, to the one who's most likely to win. And I think I made a call the other day to, I'm running for re-election. It's fairly small scale. I have a serious challenger, but I expect to win, but in any case, I called up a developer and I asked for $200. The campaign limit is $350. The developer said, well, gosh, what's the limit? I said, well, it's $350. He said, well, I always give the limit, so I want to give you $350. And I said, okay. Then that evening, I started thinking about it. And I thought about the fact that there was several projects the developer had in mind, in fact, that were in process, that would eventually become before my committee. So the next day I called up and I said, you know, I don't think it's really in your interest or in my interest for me to have a $350 contribution. I would rather have $150. Now, what does that mean? I suppose zero would have been better. But that's the kind of shadowy world I think that campaign financing is. And it's a very, I think it's a quite corrupt system.
Mm-hmm. Well, do you feel that the PACs then expect votes their way, like especially on a national level?
I'll describe one PAC that, because I used to work in the field, I saw their newsletters on their PACs and so on, and that's insurance industry, and they had these things about talking about which members of the tax writing committees they had contributed money to. It was astounding sums of money to not all members of Congress, but 20 or 30 members of the tax writing committees. And the insurance industry was one of the few that came out of the Federal Tax Reform Act pretty untouched. And they made good buys, and they were real proud of it, too, how successful they had been in it. I'd suggest very few. Did you succeed in the public financing for city elections?
Because we haven't.
There are very few cities that have that. And statewide ones, I don't know the number of states, but it's not a lot. And at the federal level, the presidential thing is getting a lot better. We've got pretty good, compared to everything else, pretty good public financing for presidential elections. But congressional one is long off, and I'd suggest at the congressional level, because the dollar amounts are so powerful, it's a real crime. Yeah, it's a scandal. And that it's very important that that be changed, but, well, the opponents of it, which tend to be incumbents because they're the ones likely, as you suggested, to get the most of the money, they like it the way it is, and the best way to defend the way it is to say, look, some politicians are looking so much for their self-interest, they want you to be forced as taxpayers to pay for their re-election or for their election. And they suggest that the people who are doing it because they're too lazy to raise the money and that you as taxpayers don't want to pay it. But when you figure what percentage of taxes that is, I mean, it's a fraction of a fraction of a percent, I'd suggest that's probably the best tax money you could spend would be to finance campaigns so that it takes the corruption out of it.
Seattle Times wrote an editorial when I was sponsoring this legislation saying, Jim Street is trying to put your money in his pocket. They called it, they entitled it Easy Street. And that's sort of the other counter mentality. And then again, I've seen Seattle Times write a series of editorials, you know, just expressing outrage at the amount of money that's being spent in special interest that are involved in the political campaign.
And that's what every politician who favors campaign finance reform faces. You can't win. You get blasted. If you don't take the money yourself, you're way under financed. If you do take the money and push for reform, they blast you for being greedy at the public expense and so on. But I'd say that's a real critical issue. And Minnesota is better than most, but I'd say we've got a long way to go, too.
As much as an incumbent has, a favorite position in accepting donations, I think the incumbent is also going to have a favorite position if you just publicly finance the campaign, because they can basically send literature out at public's expense ahead of time, because we have congressmen in this state sending opinion polls all the time that they don't pay for out of their own pocket. So their name is always out in front of people. Now someone's going to run against them doesn't have that ability.
I would say that has nothing to do with the public financing thing, because Congress, there's no public financing. Yet at the congressional level is where all these questionnaires, and I'll guarantee you, there's one.
We have it in our state level in the state.
At the state level, you're financing congressional ones. But I would.
No, we have state senators, state representatives that send out stuff.
In Minnesota, we don't, but at the federal level, there is that stuff going out all the time. I'd suggest if you have public financing, it may help counterbalance that, because each candidate's going to have the same amount of it, and therefore you can at least, you're not going to be up against both the fact that the incumbent's been sending out all these mailings at public expense and the fact that they're going to be better financed in the campaign. At least you'd be equally financed in the campaign and you'd have a fair shot, and you could make something of the fact that how many of these mailings they send out. And I've seen some congressmen who send them out literally once or twice a week. They send out mailings, and they must hit every constituent four or five times a year, not for the sole purpose of informing them, but largely for getting their name in front of them. And I'll agree that there is some problem there in how you distinguish between what is legitimate information to the constituents and what is get myself reelected time kind of stuff. Is a tough point to do. I personally have to pay for all my constituent newsletters and so on. That comes out of my pocket. I have a stamp allowance every year, but that gets pretty much used up in the regular constituent mail. So I can't do it that way. And yet Minnesota does have a public finance system. As an incumbent, I've got other advantages than that. And at the federal level or here, your state legislators have an additional advantage because of that. It's real hard to decide what's legitimate and what's not legitimate as far as constituent newsletters, but I'd argue that it's totally separate from the campaign finance, public finance type of issue, and that if we have public financing, at least the non-incumbent has an equal shot as far as campaign dollars goes.
being you mentioned Humphrey, and he came originally from South Dakota. Mm-hmm. In fact, I went to college with him. And he was the boy who seemed to have the wherewithal to speak and to recognize some of these issues that come up in campaigns. South Dakota does not have a lot of people, does not have a lot of money. He saw Minnesota and Minneapolis in particular, and he was one of those fellows who knew when and where and how to do it. So South Dakota contributed a little bit to Minnesota there, and he got a little credit there that he came originally from South Dakota. And money is quite a problem, and it was for him too. Mm-hmm. Because during the Depression days, you know, they were running a very fine drug store. I think they sold more medication and drugs under the counter than over. But that never came up in the campaign because he was in Minnesota. Most of them didn't know that. But Hubert was a pretty good politician, I would say.
I don't want to comment on somebody saying that he sold medicine under the counter because I have no awareness of that, and I can't defend him and I can't criticize him because I have no awareness of that, and so I don't choose to get into that. However, Hubert Humphrey was a masterful politician in knowing how to get elected, and partly because he loved people. I'll guarantee you most politicians hate going door to door. There are the dogs, there's the rain, there's everything else. And it takes a lot of time. And would you rather spend your time going knocking on strangers' doors and, hi, I'm here for running for office. Bang, you get the door. It doesn't happen a lot. I was pleasantly surprised how rarely it happened. But nevertheless, it happened. Most politicians don't like that. Hubert Humphrey did love people. He was very outgoing. I'd say he was a masterful politician, but I'd also say he was a very compassionate, concerned person who fought for things that weren't always popular. And he could go out and argue for something like civil rights or for spending more money to take care of senior citizens in nursing homes because it was the right thing to do, not because it was something that was in my personal self-interest as a voter. And so I'd suggest that where one stands on the issues and how masterful they are as a candidate are two totally separate things, and that perhaps the thing we can hope for best is that the best candidates are also the most thoughtful and best leaders to have for our country and such.
John, you're talking about Hubert Humphrey. I think I recall, I wasn't aware, I heard his civil rights speech, but I wasn't aware that it was 1948. And you consider that it was 1954 when the Brown, the equal rights thing came out. And you're talking 6 years before that, and we had just come out of a war and had all the, there was, The country, we had also had segregated armed forces. You had blacks in one.
Yeah, it was a very courageous. I don't want to spend a lot of time on Hubert Humphrey because it was just one example I wanted to use. But you got a good point. It was extremely unpopular to do what he was doing at the time, and he had the guts to do that. I want to take people who haven't had a chance to ask questions yet. Because I've seen a number of other hands and the time is running out fairly quickly. You did, somebody right behind you did? Mm-hmm. Others who haven't.
Yeah, I got a question. In your background, what did you find most helpful in preparing you to become a state senator? Were you working for another senator, a law degree? I don't know what you have.
Bachelor of Arts degree. I'd suggest a liberal arts background because it helps you learn how to learn and how to think. Familiarity with the process. Familiar with the issues, all of which came largely from having worked at a legislature at the federal level and so on. I think that all helped. Obviously, most people who run for office never have that chance beforehand. People run for governor, for president, for every kind of office without any prior legislative or government background whatsoever, and I would argue it doesn't necessarily make them any worse as political leaders. The main qualification one needs in practicality is the ability to get elected, but in terms of being effective, in terms of knowing the issues, the more you read, the more you learn about at the state level and truly at the national level, political leaders have to be, quote, experts in every field of endeavor, and that's obviously impossible, but the more carefully read you are, the more thoughtful you are, the more time you spend trying to learn, and the more effectively you can learn, the better you'll be. So I'd suggest educational background and ability to learn are most important. Other things, or do we exhaust the... If so, you both have asked questions before? Okay, well, go ahead.
I'm just wondering, because of some of the recent events, more on federal level, but being that we have a constitutional republic, and that's supposed to be the guiding document to which you govern when you're an elected official, how much do you think that really plays a role in how an elected official really views whether or not he has the authority to do something or not do something?
As far as like the preamble to it, or actually the words of the Constitution in limiting us?
I'd have to say just the words of the Constitution.
Okay, in that way I would suggest, I'm not going to propose a bill that I think is unconstitutional. On the other hand, I'm certainly willing to, when I think there's uncertainty about it, if I have an idea that I think is a good idea, would be good for our society, I'm going to propose that, and if I can get through the legislature and it passes, signed into law, then we will face the constitutional challenge. I had one bill this year that it was threatened many times, it was unconstitutional, and it was going to be thrown into court, and it's been a couple of months since it passed. It hasn't been yet. It dealt with cigarette advertising, and my thesis is that once people are hooked on cigarettes, which they all start to do when they're teenagers, 90% or more of adult smokers start when they're teenagers. Therefore, instead of trying to get people to quit once they're hooked on it, we ought to be trying to prevent new people from starting up. And so my way of going about this was to try and restrict, like in tax-exempt publications, like our newspapers are, restrict cigarette advertising. Require, like they did for the airwaves in the late 60s, if you buy tobacco advertising, you have to buy counter public health advertising. There's been a Supreme Court ruling at the federal level that suggests that legal activity can be restricted in advertising. And the border between civil liberties and truth in advertising kind of concerns, I think I had come up with a very good compromise on how to go about it, and half of what I wanted got through, the other half got thrown off. But in terms of the Constitution, the other side, the Tobacco Institute, had three lawyers come in from Washington telling people how it was clearly unconstitutional, first of all, and clearly in violation of a federal law preempting states from dealing with this. And I talked with a good number of lawyers, and I told it was all uncertain. It was told that it was all uncertain, and you've got a real good case on this. You might lose, but you got a good case. I thought it was a good enough case that I did pursue the bill and did get half of it through, and we'll find out now. Again, they may fully challenge it. They may win. I don't know. But my feeling is I shouldn't intentionally go out and introduce something that I know to be unconstitutional. The trouble is most things aren't so crystal clear, and in that case, if I think it's a good public policy thing, I'm going to propose and leave the courts to decide that issue. We have a few more minutes. Any other questions? Yes, up above.
Who would you like to see as the next president?
I know that answer.
I was not trying to be particularly partisan, but I will tell you where I stand because I'm not hiding it and I'm proud of it. And it happens to be an individual who was at Holden Village last year. It's a U.S. Senator from Illinois, Paul Simon.